Nashville.
Another undersea cable break has disrupted communications between Europe and the Middle East. It's the second break in the major fiber optic cables that stretch along the floor of the Mediterranean Sea. The new break near Alexandria, Egypt, is in 240-mile deep waters. Most transmissions are being rerouted, but they're slow and less reliable. France Telecom says repairs could take a week. A week after a coup in Guinea, the ruling military junta has nominated a banker, Kabine Komora, as prime minister, fulfilling a promise to appoint a civilian leader. Komora is currently based in Egypt, where he is a top official for the African Export-Import Bank. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org.
This is David Inge. We're planning another cooking show and looking for hearty chili, soup, and stew recipes. Send your recipe by January 2nd to Chili, Soups, and Stews, WILL-TV, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. We'll put together a cookbook and choose several chefs to join Doyle Moore and me for a live cooking special in March. Learn more at WILL.illinois.edu.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign. Now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a little bit about how it is over time here in America we have thought about the First Amendment and the right to free speech. And we'll be talking very specifically also about the life of someone who in his time, I think it was fair to say, was one of the best known, one of the most famous, some people might say most infamous, of Americans, the great labor leader and socialist leader Eugene Debs. He was, among other things, a candidate for president a number of times. The last time that he ran for president from jail, where he was serving a prison term for speaking out against World War I. We'll be talking in this hour with Ernest Freeberg. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Tennessee. And he's written a book about Eugene Debs and about this particular period in his life and in American history. The title of his book is Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene V. Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent. It is published by the Harvard University Press. It's been out for a little while now, so I'm sure you could find it in a bookstore or in the library if you'd like to read the book. Professor Freeberg, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. You know, I think that in part, my interest in having you on the show and talking about this book is that it gives us an opportunity to talk about Eugene Debs. And I expect that there will be, I don't know how many people who have no idea who Eugene Debs was, or maybe they would have this sense that he was somebody who was an important labor leader, or somehow an important figure in the politics of the left of this country, but maybe their grasp of who he was in his life wouldn't be very good.
Right.
So that I suppose is the natural place to start, just to talk kind of generally about Eugene Debs and who he was.
Right. Eugene Debs was born in Terre Haute, Indiana, not long after the Civil War, and he started out as a railroad worker. He was a Democratic congressman from Indiana for a while. But really rose to national attention when he got involved as the leader of the American Railway Union when he got drawn into the Pullman strike. He was imprisoned for refusing to back down to obey a government injunction to stop that strike, and ended up in prison and for 6 months in Woodstock, Illinois. And there he converted to socialism. He decided that the system that had brought him to prison for standing up for workers' rights was bankrupt, was corrupted by capitalism. And so he joined what was an emerging socialist movement in the 1890s and became the head of that movement as the presidential candidate, starting in 1900 and running every 4 years, with the exception of 1916 up through 1920.
Mm-hmm. And this election, this particular election we're talking about, this one that where he was in jail, this was the in 1920,
his last run. And it was different than the others because for the run in 1900 through 1912, he was building a significant third-party force, he and many others around the country. Debs was really sort of the unifying figure. Many of the socialist leaders were immigrants, but Debs was a real homegrown radical who conveyed socialism to the American people as something equivalent to the abolition of slavery, for example. He just said, just as the abolitionists had fought against racial slavery, the socialists are out to overturn wage slavery. And he portrayed socialism as really a very American, you know, the next logical step in the fulfillment of democracy. And he invoked Tom Paine and John Brown and Walt Whitman and so forth, and really was a person who I think was responsible for a lot of the electoral success of the party up until 1912.
Well, that was one of the things that I'm certainly interested in talking about, what kind of electoral success socialism had, particularly at that time. Let's say we're talking about, you know, before World War II, certainly. One of the things that's really noteworthy is that when he made this particular run for the presidency that we're talking about when he was in prison, he got what seems to me to be a significant number of votes. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the population of the country was at the time, so how many votes were cast. But can you say something about just what sort of particularly electoral support that socialists had to that at that point?
Right, sure. And 1912 was really, in many ways, the high water mark for the Socialist Party in terms of the electoral campaign. And Debs, in 1912, got 6% of the vote. He got close to 1 million votes out of 15 million or so. And that really was the peak in terms of percentage of support. And 6% is a pretty significant third-party movement. It's quite clear the mainstream parties were aware of and nervous about the development of socialism. They adopted many of the more modest parts of the socialist proposal in order to head off what seemed like a growing radicalism in the country. In my reading of it, the Debs got about the same number of votes in 1920, but the circumstances had changed because the war had pretty much devastated the Socialist Party. And I think many of the people who voted for Debs in 1920 were really protesting the fact that he was in prison. They weren't casting a vote for socialism. They were casting a vote for free speech.
Mm-hmm. And this here, I think, is another important part of the story, and that is it gives an opportunity to talk a little bit about our commitment, and it's certainly been imperfect over time, to the principle of free speech. And I think now, for example, depending on how people feel about the Gulf War, I think that people would broadly defend this principle that says we have this right to criticize the war, to criticize the government, to say, you know, what close to whatever you might want to say about the performance of the president and his administration. Certainly the way that people have read the First Amendment has not always so clearly and enthusiastically underwritten people's right essentially to do just that.
That's absolutely right, and I think World War I is really a turning point in the country for a variety of sort of complicated reasons. But prior to World War I, most Americans were proud of their tradition of free speech, but the idea that the Supreme Court was the mediator for free speech rights is a modern post-World War I idea. And many speech rights were really determined by community law, by state law. And many unpopular speakers were denied what we would think of as speech rights on the ground that they were disturbing the peace. So somebody who was promoting labor organizing or promoting birth control or promoting any number of unpopular causes radical causes at that point were silenced on the grounds that they were not being responsible users of their right of free speech. And it was really in World War I where the government took an unprecedented step to silence dissenters that it became a national issue. And it's really in that period that the people who were rising to defend the rights of free speech started to shape the arguments that we're familiar with today about free speech rights in time of war.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's interesting to look back and to at least reflect on what were some of the important issues for socialists at this time, particularly because now there's so much tossing this word around, socialist and socialism. And certainly it is the case that socialists at that time believed that capitalism was a problem and were intent on changing that. But the other thing that I think is really striking is if you look at some of their other issues, particularly social issues, things that had to do with workers, working conditions, things that had to do with what they considered to be the responsibilities of the government for health and welfare, those sorts of things. If you look now at some of the positions that they argued, they don't seem particularly radical to us now. And in fact, much of what they argued for is now commonplace and has been for some time.
Well, that's absolutely right. The Socialist Party was divided along, as any party is, between those who were on the left and the right, and much of the right wing of the Socialist Party. They actually won a number of municipal offices. They had some representatives in Congress, and they pursued things like controlling utilities in towns and tight regulation of worker safety rules and so forth, things that we now consider to be sort of standard parts of the social safety network. Were advocated by the all of the party, but particularly successfully by the sort of right wing of the party. Now, the left wing wanted, you know, said that this was what they called socialism, and it wasn't going to deliver what people really needed. That until capitalism was truly defeated, until that democracy couldn't possibly function, that the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few was going to make it impossible for people to govern themselves. The political system would always be corrupted and so forth. And so the ultimate solution had to be not just the sort of piecemeal social safety network reforms, but rather a drastic transformation in the American economic system.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Ernest Freeburg. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Tennessee, and he is the author of the book Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent. It's published by the Harvard University Press and takes a look at Eugene Debs and at the Socialist Party and the aims of the party at the time, but particularly it looks at his prosecution, conviction, and his imprisonment for speaking out against World War I, and how that played out, his running for the president for the last time from prison. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just maybe a little bit more about Eugene Debs, and it sounds as if he was a very charismatic man and would have been a great speaker, and I'm sure that it would have been quite the thing if you had actually had the opportunity to hear him. And it was something that people literally lined up to do when he made speeches.
That's right. The socialists were very proud of the fact that they did not have campaign donations from corporations or from wealthy individuals, but rather they raised money by selling tickets to see Eugene Debs speak for a modest amount of money. And he would pack the house wherever he went, traveling around the country in his railroad train called the Red Special. And he and his entourage would carry with them propaganda pamphlets and so forth and sell those for a dime or so, explaining the principles of socialism and so forth. And yes, he was loved and hated. You know, people often called him the most loved and the most hated man in America in his time period. And whether people loved or hated him, everybody agreed that he was a very, very powerful speaker. Not the most analytical. He wasn't a policy wonk, as we call them today, but rather he was a motivator, and he certainly was very effective at that.
How did the media of the time react to him? Did they was he someone that they took seriously?
Well, They had to take him seriously as in 1912 as he won 6% of the vote, but an awful lot of them went out of their way to demonize Debs. There was an awful lot of scandal, false accusations about the socialists being interested in nationalizing women, or claims that Debs was actually built a beautiful mansion out of scab labor and so forth. And a lot of these things were out there in the press. What I think we forget is the fact that the socialists themselves and the left wing had a very vibrant press of its own at that time period. Much of that was crushed and silenced during World War One. But Debs was not just a speaker, but a journalist, and he had a wide range of outlets, magazines, and newspapers for his views, able to reach the working class. The most notable of these is the Appeal to Reason weekly newspaper published in Kansas that, at its height, reached about 700,000 weekly subscribers. So it was quite large. So the left had its own press in that regard.
And I'm just one of the things that I think is noteworthy, I guess, is that some of the elements of what now people like to call, sometimes derisively, the mainstream media, who are also considered by people on the right, considered to be liberal, were some of the hardest, and I suppose one of the outlets I think about is the New York Times. Some of these people were extraordinarily hard and said very strong and very negative things about Eugene Debs.
Absolutely, and certainly in the midst of the war, particularly, they very much helped to spread the idea that Debs was not entitled to his own opinion, but was in fact a traitor to the country for taking his anti-war stand. They were strong backers of what they considered to be a noble war to promote democracy, and considered Debs to be out of bounds with his criticism.
Well, in the run-up to the war, World War One, what generally was the mood of the country? Were there a lot of people who said, yes, this is important, and supported the war effort, supported the idea of sending soldiers? Or was the, what was the level of controversy and debate about whether the United States should be involved at all?
Well, the country was deeply divided about the war. I think it's easy for us to forget that. When the war broke out in 1914, one thing all Americans on all sides agreed was this is something that the United States should not get involved in. There were a few who argued and a growing number who argued that we should prepare. And as time went on, by 1916, the government was starting to begin a military buildup. But still, Woodrow Wilson ran in 1916 on the campaign on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And many people voted for him for his second term with the idea that he was the best bet that the United States would be able to stay out of the war and to serve as a mediator for the peace. So when war finally did break out, when the United States entered the war in April of 1917, the country was very, very divided, and the government faced the enormous task of needing to draft an army. The army was minuscule at that point and very underprepared. So in order to have any sort of impact on the war in Europe, the United States suddenly had to draft an army of what amounted to 4 million soldiers and find a way to ship them overseas and put them into one of the worst military nightmares the world had ever seen. Mm-hmm. It was a formidable task, and the country remained very, very divided about that.
And
there were isolationists in the Midwest, including in the Senate. Robert La Follette, as the leader from Wisconsin, suggesting this was a big mistake, that the United States should not get involved in the European war.
And here, I was, pardon me for interrupting you, but here this is another interesting part of the story, because here, as you say, the Wilson administration had a country that was divided, had already campaigned on, as you say, on keeping America out of the war. So now the administration faced this challenge of selling the war, trying to influence public opinion to persuade most people that it was actually a good thing for the United States to be involved. So how did they do that, or how did they try to do that?
Well, they did it in two ways. One way was through a massive propaganda campaign. The government hired 75,000 of the best artists, writers, historians, designers that they could find to spew out an enormous volume of pamphlets and movies and the sort of famous posters from that time period that many of us associate with World War I, to demonize the Germans to sort of sell the war effort. This was something that had never been done on this scale before, and it was enormously effective in stirring up sort of patriotic fervor, both for good and for ill. So that was one part of it. It was a massive propaganda campaign, and the other was to silence those voices that still were resisting. The isolationists that I mentioned, many immigrant groups, particularly German Americans, were understandably ambivalent about getting involved in the war against their home country. The Irish, another large immigrant group in the country, many of them were ambivalent about doing anything to help the English at that point. And a large number of Russian Jews were in the country because they were escaping the persecution of the Tsar. And so the idea of joining an alliance, which at that point was included the Russian Tsar, they were very uninterested in that. And the socialists were really the best organized critics of the war. And so the determination was made by the government that in addition to propaganda, there needed to be tools to silence them.
And they actually, the Wilson administration actually argued for literally having the power to censor the press.
Right. And the press pushed back right away on that. The initial proposal from the Wilson administration was to appoint the Secretary of the Army and the Secretary of the Navy and the head of propaganda, George Creel, to be a censorship board that would be able to determine and really powerfully punish newspapers if they published anything that might be seen to be against the war effort. And newspapers rallied against that and managed to overturn that provision and protect that. You know, they claimed for the most part that they were patriotic supporters of the war, and they had to be trusted. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't interested in giving away troop movements and so forth. But they did want the right to be able to be critical of their government. So, and that part of it was overturned. But what remained in what was called the Espionage Act in 1917 were some provisions that were less well discussed at the time, that turned out to be very powerful tools for silencing the radical press as well as the radical speakers.
And this I guess you're pointing at the post office as a weapon of censorship, and that is what they managed to do was they could get at the mailing privileges for any publication right. that they determined was speaking against the war effort, and that was something that and you mentioned before that there was actually this very lively socialist press, and this really really hit them very hard.
That's right. There is one sort of bedrock principle in free speech law in the country is that there's no prior restraint. The government does not have the right to ban publication in advance. So what the government did was say, well, you have a right to publish your magazine, but you don't have the right to use the post office to mail it. So we're allowing you to publish. We're just not allowing you to actually reach an audience. And that bankrupted the appeal to reason that I mentioned until they were willing to buckle and change their position on the war, and quite a number of other newspapers. And those that didn't had to be very careful about what they said, for fear of being silenced and bankrupted by the press, by the post office.
We have a couple of callers here, and we will continue, of course, to talk with our guest, Ernest Freeburg. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Tennessee and is author of the book Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent. It's published by the Harvard University Press and talks about the movement against World War I, of which Debs was an important part. As the guest has explained, the country was actually very divided about this, and there were people who spoke out against the war, and for that, Mr. Debs, as well as some other people, ended up in jail, and when he ran for president for the last time, this was in 1920, he actually ran from jail. and received something like, was it about a million votes, more than a million votes?
Just under a million.
There's a picture here, in fact, on the front of the book, and I'm assuming, was this a real thing? It's a button. It's a campaign button, as we're still now used to, with Eugene Debs' picture on it, and it says, for president, convict number 9653. They actually made these up.
That's right, and that's a you can see from behind him in this picture that's the bars of the Atlanta Penitentiary, the federal penitentiary where he was. That's sort of a famous photograph of him taken when he was receiving the nomination. His party had to come down to the steps of the Atlanta Penitentiary and let him know that he'd been nominated for his fifth run for the presidency.
So that's actually and actually that photograph is reproduced in the book as a photograph of him standing there with all these people, and I think, as I remember, he's holding some flowers something like that. And so they just took that little piece of him that's just on the button. You just see his head basically, but as you say, back behind him, you can see the bars that are on the door that he's standing in front of.
That's right.
Yeah.
Debs was used, as I said, Debs was used to traveling around the country, giving speeches to thousands in Madison Square Garden and various places around the country. And in the 1920 election, he was basically confined to the prison hospital where he worked, and he was allowed to send out a brief newspaper sort of editorial about every week for 8 weeks leading up to the campaign. Newspapers could either run it or not at their discretion. That was the extent of his ability to actually reach the public in 1920.
We have a couple of callers. Let's talk first with the first in line, and this is someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Good morning. It's a wonderful topic, a very timely topic for today, to think back on how far American politics has come, really. And I was thinking about this, especially in terms of, you'd mentioned La Follette in passing, and how odd it seems now for there to have been not just one, but two very significant political movements of the left at this time in American history. And so I was curious to know a little bit more about how those two interacted. You know, did the socialists and progressives cooperate in certain areas? Did they compete in others? What was their relationship like? What was each of their relationship like to labor as well, which has always been a very potent source of power for parties on the left? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, initially, I think there was when the socialism was at its peak, there was a certain antagonism. Debs was a great admirer of La Follette, and they exchanged commiserating letters when La Follette took his stand against the war. Debs spoke up for him publicly and privately. La Follette spoke out for Debs' free speech rights and campaigned to get him out of prison. But they did have different ideas about the proper path forward, with the socialists feeling as if the progressive movement was too accommodating toward capitalism, and that ultimately control of the ownership of the means of production was the key, and that progressives like La Follette were too hopeful of the possibility of a sort of a democratic capitalism. In the aftermath of the war, as the Socialist Party is devastated, Debs rethinks this, especially as he sees his own party splinter into a strong communist faction that he refuses to support. So in the 1924 election, he reluctantly throws his support behind La Follette's sort of broader movement, and the socialists through the 20s are moving in that direction toward a broader labor party, trying to find a way to, that rather than bring labor to them, rather to reach the left side of the labor movement as effectively as possible and engage them politically in the long run.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the call. We'll go to someone else here. Charleston, line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to start just by saying that my grandfather was a local labor leader out in San Francisco with the Newspaper Guild, and growing up, he would tell me often that he proudly voted for Eugene V. Debs in that 19 the election while he was in prison. So I've heard that name in my family for quite some time. And just another point, as you were talking, you mentioned the propaganda that the United States engaged in hiring the best writers, et cetera. Not too long ago, I think our public television brethren broadcast a story about Rudyard Kipling. And, you know, England doing pretty much the same thing, hiring their best writers to promote this war. The question
absolutely, America did not invent this approach to propaganda, but was picking up on what had been worked out in England.
Right. The previous caller prefaced by saying how far we've come politically, and I'm kind of thinking we've gone a little backwards, where we're down to just two mainstream parties, and there is a socialist candidate, of course, but it's not the one who's been accused of being a socialist, to put it that way. I missed some of the discussion, and I was just curious if you'd covered this, and if not, please, I'd like to hear it. Would it have been the 1912 election then that you had Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party, as well as Eugene Debs and the Socialist Party running? Is that
That's right. Uh-huh.
And just comparatively, I mean, I've always heard of the Bull Moose Party being, you know, the most successful of the third party out there. Was Debs and socialism anywhere closer?
No, not in terms of numbers. Roosevelt was more. I don't have the number off the top of my head right now, but he did significantly better than the Socialist Party did. The Progressive Party and Roosevelt's advisors very explicitly said we need to take what they considered to be the sane part of the socialist program, and so much of their platform was the sort of reform ideas of socialism with health and safety regulations and. Support for various progressive reforms, and that was very effective in undercutting some of the broader appeal for the Socialist Party.
And so, just lastly, was the 1920 election Debs's heyday? Is that his best showing in the national election?
Yeah, there's an important difference, I think, because in 1912, about a million people voted for Debs, but they were voting for the socialist program. Mm-hmm. In 1920, there were only about 10,000 dues-paying socialists left in the party. The party had been decimated by government prosecution, as well as by a split between those who wanted to side with the Bolsheviks and those who refused to side with the Bolsheviks. So the party was battered, and the party ran Debs. And made a very explicit appeal to people to say a vote for Debs is a vote for free speech rights. It doesn't matter what your position is on socialism. What matters is this is a way to stand up and protest against the fact that Debs had been sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Well, that would coincide with my grandfather's work with the Newspaper Guild then.
Uh-huh, yes. So he got a lot of support from people who, you know, were not themselves socialists, but Woodrow Wilson
preach.
Called on the country to say this is a referendum on the League of Nations in 1920, but the socialists said no, it's a referendum on the government's persecution of dissent during World War I.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you
for
the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Wanted to just have you talk just a little bit more about the Espionage and Sedition Acts. We did talk a little earlier about the government exercising its power by working through the post office and getting at people's mailing rights, and that was something that really crippled the left-wing press. There were some other aspects of this that, though, that went to this issue of what it was you could say, and that's where ultimately Debs ends up being jailed. So, can you just talk a little bit more about the provisions of these two acts?
Right. I mean, the Espionage Act sounds misleading because it seems to be targeting spies in the country, but in fact, it was never used to prosecute any spies. There were German spies, but they were not prosecuted under this law. The law included a clause that said that it was illegal to intentionally try to cause insubordination, mutiny, refusal of duty in the military, basically inciting people to mutiny. And prosecutors made this argument. They said that when a when a person like Debs stands up and makes a speech against the war, what they're really doing, while they're not admitting it, what they're really doing is trying to convince young men in the audience not to do their duty by registering for the draft. One of the standard exceptions we have for free speech is that we're not allowed to use our speech to incite people to break the law. So in a sense, the government used that exception and said, we're not silencing Debs because he doesn't like the war. We're silencing him because what he's really trying to do is undermine the draft, trying to convince people to break the law by not registering. And there were a large number of young men across the country who were not at all interested in participating in the draft, and there was a large effort to try to round these people up. But it was really that provision that was used by the federal prosecutors to silence Debs.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, and let me ask you specifically, the speech for which he was prosecuted and jailed was a speech that he gave in Canton, Ohio.
Right.
And this was in 1918. What did he say?
Well, it was a long speech, about 2 hours long. There were federal agents in the audience taking notes. He knew they were there. For the most part, what he says in the course of that 2 hours is sort of standard socialist fare. But he does turn, he says a few things that the government picks up on. One is he defends his many comrades who were already in prison, and he says they were wrongly imprisoned. So for making that comment, he's in a sense attacking the government's war policy, and so that's used against him. And then he makes the broad socialist argument that this is a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, that it's the working class who ends up suffering in a war, and it's the wealthy, it's the ruling class, that gets to decide when wars are fought, and ultimately it's the ruling class that ends up making profits off of war. So for making that argument, which had been a standard socialist argument against war long before the war broke out, but for saying that in Canton, he was arrested and put on trial in 1918 and sentenced to 10 years in prison for that.
Let's take some of the calls here. We have someone here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. In recounting the opposition at the time of the First World War, I think it's sort of important to note that William Jennings Bryan actually resigned. It would have been as if Colin Powell took seriously his opposition or his, misgivings about the Gulf attack on Iraq and would have actually resigned over
right.
it. So I think that's an interesting thing to note,
sure.
that it was actually at the high levels of government where opposition was. It wasn't simply these rabble-rousers I'm so fond of. But,
and a large number of Christian pacifists, Brian representing a sort of broader movement in the country to reject all war and to seek mediation. So you're absolutely right. That's another, and quite a number of them ended up as conscientious objectors, about 500 of those in military prisons during the war as well.
When he was running, Wikipedia, I was just trying to brief myself, he ran three times, and a friend of mine always cites this quote about it's better to have voted for somebody you actually want to have in, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering which election that actually might have been cited at.
I've ran into that quote often in his career.
Mm-hmm.
He would have to break that out just about every election eve. As he was facing the prospect of another electoral defeat.
Yeah, I guess. What I was trying to get at was the idea that I actually don't know which elections that it would have been where what. I'm having a hard time being articulate today. I don't know too much of politics, I guess. But the idea I was trying to get at is that he could say that when he was running against two war candidates, which I think is what the case was at the time, where there actually not only was you'd be voting for somebody who you weren't at all approving of, it was somebody that you would in no case, in neither case would you have approved of. But I'm not
right.
Sure
although Debs took that position, not just involving war. In his view, both the major parties were working against the interests of the working class long before the war. And his view of politics, his participation in politics, he made it very clear that he didn't expect that he was going to win any election, but rather that this was an educational process that he was involved in to try to raise working class consciousness. So in any of the war of the elections that he had you know, no expectation that he was going to win, and repeatedly was grappling with the question of why, in his view, working people would vote against their own self-interest.
Just one last thing, then. I have not attended it myself, but periodically there in Terre Haute, or is it in New Harmony, there's an occasional Debs dinner where people get together and toast his memory and talk about, and there's usually a contemporary speaker. I was wondering if your research led you to attend one of those. And
I have not. I've always intended to. I believe you're talking about a Debs dinner that occurs at his home in Terre Haute at the Debs Foundation puts on. Yes, quite a cast of luminaries have been honored there over the years.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I have another caller I want to get to, and I want to thank the last. And just very quickly, again, introduce our guest for this hour, Ernest Freeburg. He is Associate Professor of History at University of Tennessee. If you'd like to read more about the story that we were talking about, you can look for his book, Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Harvard University Press. We have another person here in Champaign County, where we are, there on our line number two. Let's talk with them. Hello.
With our concern about security and the surveillance of citizens, World War One apparently had its own version of spying on Americans. Jeremiah O'Leary, for example, had his offices burglarized, apparently, by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Was Debs similarly spied on by the FBI? And I'll hang up and see what your thoughts are about that kind of issue.
Yes, it seems clear that he was. I've been in the federal Justice Department records, and he is clearly being followed. He repeatedly, in his correspondence, mentions in this time period that he feels as if things he's written are not getting through the mail, that they're being intercepted, and so forth. So yes, he was considered himself to be under surveillance. The government also did an unusual thing in World War One, in that it openly encouraged private citizens to also spy on their neighbors and to report tips of suspicious behavior and so forth, and actually deputized some of these vigilante groups to set them loose on their neighbors. And so Debs was clearly, the evidence suggests, there were other sort of private citizens who felt it their duty to keep an eye on him and report his movements. There wasn't any doubt in Debs' case that he was a radical and that he was anti-war, so you know, there wasn't much news to report in that regard that the FBI or the federal government wouldn't have already known about.
He had, when he was sent to prison, he had many supporters, people who argued that he should not have been convicted, that he shouldn't be in jail. They tried to make this argument to the White House at the very top. And they were people, maybe not necessarily people who were all socialists or who embraced completely the socialist agenda, but were very much concerned about the feeling that he had the right to say what he said. And they were, their big concern was the First Amendment. Who were some of the people who argued that it was wrong to put him in jail and that the president essentially should let him out?
Well, it's really, in many ways, a sort of who's who of artists and writers, particularly on the left in that time period. So Woodrow Wilson and then later Harding heard from Clarence Darrow and Upton Sinclair and Sinclair Lewis and Carl Sandburg, and you know the list goes on and on. Robert La Follette, Alice Paul, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, so forth. So there were quite a number of people. Many of them people who reluctantly, you know, they didn't raise their voice during the war as Debs was heading off to prison, but felt that once the war was over, they either rethought their position or they took the position. Well, it might have been one thing to put him in jail to silence him in a time of emergency, but now that the war is over, we need to begin national healing by letting these people out. And Debs was really the most famous and really the most notable of hundreds and hundreds of people who were put in prison, sentenced to as much as 20 years in prison. There were 1,200 people convicted under these national laws, as well as an uncounted number of people under state laws.
His experience in prison must have been unusual, at least to the extent that he was somebody who was famous. I'm sure that a lot of people, when he arrived at that prison, knew who he was. What sort of experience did he have when he was in the prison?
Well, the wardens were very aware of the fact that he was being watched. And Debs also, his charisma carried with him into prison as well. And he actually developed deep friendships with his wardens. He was sent first to the Moundsville State Penitentiary in West Virginia, and then later transferred to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary. So he had several wardens, and in every single case, the wardens sized him up and realized he was not the villain that the press had portrayed him as being. So he got some extra privileges. He was often insisting that he not get special privileges, but they would assign him to fairly light duty in the hospital. Debs was a strong believer in prison reform, and the wardens in each case seemed to have been willing to sit down and listen to him and even adopt some of his ideas for prison reform. And they were, across the board, deeply appreciative of the way Debs reached out to prisoners. As far as Debs was concerned, these prisoners were the ultimate victims of the capitalist system, that it was that a prison is a tool for the rich to use against the poor, and it's only the poor who end up in prison. So for Debs, as a socialist, he felt like his mission to reach the working class carried right with him into prison. And so he spent a lot of time in prison writing letters for prisoners and offering them advice and counsel, and he received packages and gifts from all around the country, books and cigars and flowers and cookies, and he would keep almost none of that for himself, and instead spread this around among the prisoners and so forth. So he had quite an impact on the prison while he was there.
There's a great story about when he was let out. He was sentenced to 10 years. He served 3, and when there was a change of administration, when Warren Harding became president, he decided to let him out. But there's this wonderful story about what happened the day that he was released.
Right. The warden, again, was you know, sorry to see Debs go. And this was on Christmas morning in 1921, and it sort of in honor of Debs leaving and in recognition of his impact on the prisoners, he allowed the prisoners out of their cells that morning and allowed them to move toward the front windows of the penitentiary. So as Debs is leaving that morning with a bunch of reporters and socialists waiting to greet him, the prisoners give him a rousing standing ovation as he's leaving. Apparently can be heard a half mile away there in Atlanta. And Debs turns, waves his hat, and tears running down his face. He later described this as really the most profound moment of his long political career.
Yeah, there's a photograph of this in the book, and it's really a remarkable picture, even though it was taken from a distance. So what you see is, Debs, you see his back,
right.
And you see the prison building, and he's standing there, and he has his hat, and he's holding it in the air and waving. And I imagine for the reporters who were there, that they were just, I'm sure that they were amazed by such a thing.
They were. Absolutely.
And then perhaps the next most amazing thing was when they realized that instead of him getting on the train and going home to Terre Haute, he was going to the White House.
That's right. Harding, nobody's exactly sure what he wanted in this regard, but he was curious to see who Debs was. This was something that was considered very controversial because, you know, many people in the country still believe that Debs was a traitor to his country, that he was one of the most dangerous radicals. Harding received enormous pressure from the American Legion, from the Ku Klux Klan, from a large number of families of veterans, saying, you know, don't let this person out. Don't bow to this public pressure for free speech. But Harding really decided it was time to move beyond this, that this was more trouble than it's worth. He decided not to inherit Woodrow Wilson's problem, so he cleared the decks a bit and let Debs out, but he wanted to meet Debs. And so Debs had a secret meeting on Christmas morning in the White House with Harding, and some suggest that Harding was asking him to tone down his political rhetoric, and Debs typically promised that he would not do that, and that he would go about his business trying to rebuild the Socialist Party. And then he headed back to Terre Haute to a rousing welcome from his hometown.
And he only lived about another 5 years.
Right. He was quite ill, actually, periodically. He was in his 60s when he was in prison, and he had a lot of health problems there, and clearly prison didn't make those any better. So when he came out of prison, he was in and out of sanitariums for quite a bit of that time. But then he did try to revive the Socialist Party through the 20s without much success, and he died in 1926.
Well, you know, we're going to have to stop. There is really much more to this story, and it's a good story. And if people are interested in exploring some of this history, they should take a look at this book that we've been talking about here once again. The title of the book is Democracy's Prisoner, Eugene Debs, The Great War and the Right to Dissent. It is published by the Harvard University Press. Ernest Freeburg is our guest. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Tennessee. He's particularly interested in conflicts over free speech and religious liberty, particularly the role of the First Amendment in American history. So you can go out and look for the book. And Professor Freeburg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks, and thanks for the very good questions from callers.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Prevena Medical Group's Diabetes and Obesity Clinic, a comprehensive clinic that addresses the patient's special needs, including nutrition, fitness, glucose monitoring, and cardiology. Appointments can be made at 217-337-1300.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Celeste Quinn. Before we get to the market update, let me share this with you. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has scheduled an afternoon news conference amid unconfirmed reports that he plans to name someone to Barack Obama's U.S. Senate seat. Citing unnamed sources, the Chicago Tribune is reporting that the governor plans to appoint former Illinois Attorney General Roland Burris. More on the story in our report of AM 580 News at 12:30. Now let's turn our attention to commodity prices. In Kansas City, March wheat is trading at $6.15. That's up $4. May, $6.25, up $2.50. In Chicago, March wheat, $5.95¾, up $3¾. July, $6.20½, up $4¾. March corn, $3.91¾, down $1¾. May, $4.02, down $2. July, $4.12½, down $1¾. September, $4.24¼, down $18¼. January beans, $9.38, down $0.50. March, $9.44, down $1½. May, $9.62½, down up $5¼. And July beans, $9.75½. And that contract up $7. January meal, $2.94 even, up $1.90. January oil, $32.11, down $10. At the Merck in Chicago, December live cattle, 86.20, up 22.5. February, 86.32.5, up 12.5. January feeder cattle, 94.35, up 90. March, 94.10, up 125. February lean hogs, 59.80, up 65. Outside markets, February crude, 38.70, down 132. The U.S. dollar, 80.79, down 60. The CRB index, 215.